Hi there, and welcome to PodRocket, a web development podcast brought to you by LogRocket. LogRocket helps software teams improve user experience with session replay, error tracking, and product analytics. Head over to logrocket.com today to try it for free. My name is Paul, and joined with us is Max Stoiber. He is a co-founder of Stellit, among some other things we're going to talk about today. And we're here to talk about front-end architectures, data layers, and something a lot of folks probably have touched or heard about or worked with, GraphQL. Welcome to the show, Max.
Thanks for having me, Paul. I just want to mention, you've got the voice for podcasting. Holy smokes. I don't know how I'm going to be able to compete with that sputtery smooth sound.
It's just filters and compressors just doing their magic.
No, seriously, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Me too. I feel like this sort of conversation was almost made for me selfishly because I'm one of those people that have used GraphQL both in a professional context, like with a startup, and in a personal context. You're like, hey, this was cool. I want to try it out for myself. And you just fail. You're like, this is way harder than it needed to be. What's going on? I don't really know. And so we're going to dig into that a little bit today. And more generally, like data layers, like what is the responsibility of a data layer? So Max, you have two different organizations at least running with these technologies. So the first one is Stellit and the other one is Fuse. So maybe we could jump into just talking a little bit about how you got into this space in general and what brought you to founding Stellit to kick things off.
Yeah, before Stellit, I founded a company called Spectrum where we were building sort of a modern take on a community forum that was really optimized for open source communities. I have a deep background in React open source. I got into React really early on. I created React Boilerplate and then co-created style components with a friend of mine. And so I've done a lot of open source projects in my life. And a big part of that has always been community, but no community platform really worked for those kinds of communities at the time. And so we ended up building something that we thought was better that eventually was acquired by GitHub. And we were using GraphQL as our core API layer for the whole platform. But basically, every data access from the client happened via our GraphQL API. And that, in many ways, was amazing, and in some ways, sucked. And one of the ways that it sucked was that we had huge scaling problems as we grew really quickly. And I knew we had to change some of our infrastructure in order to alleviate some of these scaling issues. But also, I knew that we're a forum, right? Most of our traffic is reads. There's few writes. It's 99% reads, pretty much. A lot of it is public, and everybody's looking at the same forum post every single time. And so I knew that caching could really help take a lot of traffic away from our API and sort of give us more time to alleviate some of the infrastructure pain and also make everything just much cheaper to run. The big problem was caching at the CDN level for GraphQL didn't exist. It just wasn't the thing that anybody was really doing. The weird thing being that actually GraphQL clients from the get-go, from the first day that GraphQL was announced, GraphQL clients basically did caching for GraphQL. And so in my head, I was like, I know GraphQL clients do this. Why can't I just take that GraphQL client and run it on a CDN to do caching for my GraphQL API for everybody rather than just for one person in a browser? And that didn't exist. And so I ended up building a version of that internally at Spectrum that eventually got acquired by GitHub. And then later on, I met my co-founder, Tim, and we decided to create a company around sort of edge caching for GraphQL and now more broadly operationalizing GraphQL. And that's where Stellit really started and came from.
It felt like a no-brainer. This thing already exists. Why isn't it deployed? Was that sort of the feeling at the time?
Yeah, it turns out it's a lot more complicated than it seems. You can't just take a GraphQL client and deploy it at the edge and to a CDN. It doesn't quite work that way. But the general sentiment was definitely like people have been doing this with both APIs at the CDN layer and with GraphQL on the client for many years now. GraphQL, the whole point of it, or a big point of it to me, is that it's a standard, right? Every single GraphQL API is based on the same strict specification. That's a big part of the reason why there's so much amazing developer experience tooling around GraphQL, right? Because if you build GraphQL and IDE for your GraphQL API, it's going to work for every GraphQL API, right? If you build a GraphQL client that fetches really efficiently from a GraphQL API, it's going to work for every GraphQL API. That's why there's so much tooling that is amazing around GraphQL that has a really great developer experience because the tooling is shareable. This isn't true for REST APIs, right? Every company builds a REST API in a slightly different way,
right?
They all have slightly different conventions. They all have different endpoint naming conventions, different versioning schemes. Everything's just slightly different to where the tooling doesn't really work in a standardized way, right? Yes, there's Swagger, which many people use. And if you follow those conventions, you will be able to use some Swagger tooling. But broadly speaking, that centralization and standardization that GraphQL brings is really powerful. And so I was like, that standardization is the case. Why am I building a GraphQL caching layer that is just like a generic GraphQL caching layer? Somebody else could have built this and given it to me. I don't want to be building stuff that isn't critical to the business, right? This was something that easily somebody else could have built and sold me, but it didn't exist. And so that's really where the business idea came from.
So you mentioned like strict standards, there's like this culture around like, this is how a GraphQL schema is made. And it actually strict about that. We're forced to define our resolvers and the actual schema itself. What do you think is missing from this picture? For example, that caching layer to have been missed in the open source community, or just a general lack of adoption, perhaps, that you might have noted that you're seeing?
Yeah, GraphQL was very overhyped when it initially came out. And I think that has hurt GraphQL's adoption for many years now. If you know that famous graph of the hype cycle and then the trough of Sora and then coming back out, we're still in the phase of coming back out of the trough of Sora after that intense hype cycle that existed around GraphQL when it was initially released. The big problem, I think, was that many people were really excited about GraphQL and started using it for things that it's terrible at. The truth is that GraphQL is a solution that was invented by Facebook to solve problems at Facebook scale, right? That's what GraphQL was invented for. And suddenly people saw that and went, oh, that looks awesome. I like the developer experience of this. Let me use it to access my database instead of SQL. And that makes no sense. Like, this language is not optimized for accessing databases. It's made to be this data access layer that can centralize and coordinate between many different teams and microservices and many different clients. You're not going to be successful using it to access a database. That's not what it's made for. That's not what it's created. You're just going to keep hitting limitations. And so people use it for all these things that it wasn't made for, eventually realize that it doesn't work and shifted away from that to just stop using it entirely. And it's got a bit of a bad reputation for not working, I think mainly because people were using it for purposes and use cases that it just honestly wasn't made for. The interesting thing is now we're getting out of that trough of sorrow after the hype cycle. And the truth is that many large organizations, once they hit the problems that GraphQL solves, which I'm happy to talk about, you don't really have a choice. There's no other technology like GraphQL. There's nothing that gives you the same benefits and trade-offs that GraphQL gives you. Basically, you either use REST and you end up in a mess of either view-specific endpoints, or you use GraphQL and you don't. Those are your two options. And then there's a little bit of an in-between with BFFs where every client team builds their own REST API, essentially, that gets access to just for their mobile app, but that just leads to duplication and issues and bugs don't get fixed consistently across all product services. Like, it's just every other option has trade-offs that are not great compared to GraphQL. And so for the use cases where GraphQL makes sense now, it's just kind of the only choice. And the companies that are using GraphQL are realizing that at the larger scale, at the enterprise scale, switching consistently to GraphQL. I think over the last 3 years, it's gone from 10% of the Fortune 100 to 50% of the Fortune 100 use GraphQL somewhere in their stack, just because that is the space where it really makes sense.
I think it's interesting that you bring up like application use space, because it's the answer to a lot of these. Should I use XYZ? Well, it depends. That's always the answer. And a lot of times the frustration of using it in the wrong spot, that's also a common symptom of stuff being new, like you mentioned in that initial rise. You also mentioned GraphQL, you get to this point where you're in the right domain, you're in the right size company, the right size stack where it makes sense. And realistically, you don't have a lot of other options when you start to solve some of these niche problems. Could we double click for a second, just explain to listeners what one of those niche problems when you get to that scale is that can't be solved with a REST paradigm?
Yeah. So for context, right, over the last 3 years of founding Stellate, I've spoken with over 1,000 organizations that use GraphQL and then a couple dozen that use REST, or maybe even 100 that use REST. I've spoken with a lot of companies about how they build APIs, basically. And there's very consistent patterns. And often at around 100 to 500 engineers in the engineering organization, what ends up happening is that these organizations that initially just used, you know, I say under air quotes, REST, often it's more like JSON over HTTP endpoints. Like, they don't even follow the REST specification. They kind of just have random endpoints that return random JSON. Nobody really follows the REST specification to the dot, because there's no tooling that enforces it. Again, it's not a standard, right? It's like a loose set of recommendations on how to name things.
The standard is no standard with the REST. Yeah,
exactly. And there's no tooling to enforce it for the most part, right? People just do whatever they want. And so what ends up happening at that scale, once you hit 100 to 400 engineers, is that you end up in a situation where either you have, if you follow the REST specification sort of more strictly, you end up in a situation where you have all these endpoints for all these entities that have to return all the data for that entity. And at that scale, at that product complexity, that is often hundreds of lines of JSON, if not 1,000 lines of JSON, that get returned from one user endpoint, right? Like, you fetch get slash user slash one, you get back 300 lines of JSON. There's no view in your product that is showing all of that information at once. That is not a thing, right? Nobody ever looks at all of that information at once. And so, unless you're building a table view, but that is a rare use case. The truth is that then you're always overfetching, and it actually starts having a major performance impact, because every single endpoint and every single request overfetches by a factor of 100 suddenly everything is much slower, right? Your database gets overloaded, your infrastructure has to scale up much more. Users are going to be less happy because it's much slower. The whole thing just starts showing its cracks on that end. On the other side of the spectrum, if you don't follow the REST specification with very specific entity level endpoints, what people often do to work around this issue is they create view specific endpoints, right? So they will have, like Facebook famously initially did, they have a slash feed endpoint. And that is only specifically for the feed view and returns exactly the data that the feed view needs. This is in a way a version of a BFF, right? A BFF is an architecture pattern where the front-end teams own specific services that take the data that they fetch from the backend and turn it into what the client needs. Each client, each front-end, each website, each mobile app owns their own BFF. And again, they create these view-specific endpoints there that just return exactly the data that that view needs. Now, again, the big problem you run into very quickly is just duplication. Right? If you do BFFs, you have duplications across clients, but even if you don't do the BFFs, you just have to do duplications across many different views, right? Fundamentally, your product has whatever n number of entities, right? Maybe 20, maybe 30, but even not much more than that, right? It's not millions usually. And so you end up with these hundreds of endpoints for all these different views, for all these different versions that your API represents, that all return slightly different data. Now suddenly, say you have to do a database migration, right? You have to update a table, you have to change a column, you have to do something, and the shape of your data changes, which happens really frequently because you just learn new things, right? Now you have 500 JSON endpoints that all write their own custom database query or use their own custom ORM syntax, and you have to find all 50 that access this specific column or this specific table and change the way that they query the table. That is a freaking nightmare. From a maintenance perspective, it just slows you down so much to have all this duplication across all these different endpoints. And so most companies are in either of these two worlds, right? That is the truth at scale. You either have a set of very strict or more strict followed REST endpoints that just return entities were just overfetched by an order of magnitude that is ridiculous, or you have view-specific endpoints which just end up in a mess of hundreds of endpoints. And so all these large organizations that I speak with that use either of basically REST or JSON over HTTP in production at scale, they end up in one of these two worlds, and neither world is great. And at that point, what do? Right? You don't really have many options to solve these problems, right? And that's why Facebook invented GraphQL. That's why it even exists, because Facebook ran into these problems. They were like, look, we have, I don't know how many data stores, I don't know how many microservices, and I don't know how many clients. If we end up building custom endpoints for every single view and on every single client, like there's no way that works, right? It's just going to break us down. And so GraphQL was invented to be that central data access layer that is flexible enough to support all the client use cases while being centralized to where it's defined once what it means to load a user. And then you can load that user once. And if the user table changes, you update that in one place and everything else still works. From a maintenance perspective, it scales and keeps you moving much better. I think that's the way I view the problems that GraphQL solves at scale. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, that was fantastic. It really highlighted it's a problem of scale that we're talking about here. We can hop a little bit into what you call GraphQL Max, which is like data access. And I'm curious what that means to you specifically. Right before we do that, I want to remind our listeners that this podcast is brought to you by Log Rocket. So if you are building a web app, no matter how big or how small, and you want to spend less time in the console debugging and get cool things like heat maps, full session replay, and surfacing of different trends that you might not have noticed for your users and for yourself developing, you can use Log Rocket to do all of that so you can spend more time developing a great app. So head over to logrocket.com today and check it out for free. So focusing back on GraphQL as a data access layer, that's what you've been calling it, Max, is it's a data access layer. It feels if it's put in a situation of scale, it's like a center hub and spoke where it's reaching out to all these other APIs and it's like consolidating the information. Is that accurate? Is it not accurate? What would you add to that?
That's definitely accurate. I don't know if you've ever seen this. There's a very famous meme about how to make pasta where you first see the flour, and then you add water to the flour and it says wet the dries. And then you take that and you dry it. So you dry the wets and then you wet the dry again by boiling it. And then you dry the wets again by taking the pasta out of the water. And then you add sauce. So you wet the dries again. It's like wet the dries, dry the wets, wet the dries, dry the wets, wet the dries, dry the wets. The same thing happens in engineering architectures. And what I mean by that is that you sort of dry the wets in the sense of you have all these microservices, right? And there's many of them. And then you have a central layer in front, ideally, that is what GraphQL is intended to be, that sort of connects all of them together and exposes them in a way that the clients want to access them. So you're sort of wetting the dries, you're sort of going from many to one. Then you're going back to many clients on the other side, so you're drying the wets again because you have an Android app, an iOS app, a website, partners, customers, whatever, that are accessing your API. And so you're sort of spreading it up to many different things again. It's sort of a funny thing about engineering architectures, how we split it up into many pieces and then we centralize, and then we split it up into many pieces and then we centralize again. And GraphQL is very much intended to be that central layer that is flexible enough to support both what all the clients need, but also be able to access anything in the background, whether that is, you know, many microservices, third-party APIs, data stores directly, whatever that is that you need to get the data from. It kind of just, GraphQL is a layer that figures out, hey, the client's asking me for a user in the top five posts. What does that mean, right? How do I get a user? And then how do I get their top five posts? Which service do I talk to? Which database do I talk to? Which API do I talk to in order to resolve that data? Now, GraphQL is very much invented as an API technology. The reason I call it the data access layer is because now the trend with React specifically and also some other frameworks is moving towards this world of React server components, right? Where part of your front end is server-side rendered. Now, we had server-side rendering for a while, but now it's moving towards more granular server-side rendering, where individual pieces of your application are server-side rendered in your infrastructure. And if you think about it, right, from a purely theoretical perspective, if I have a server-side rendering server that is running in my infrastructure, in my cloud, wherever I'm hosted, then sending a network request from that to an API that is hosted on a separate server that is right next to my server-side rendering server is a pure waste of overhead, right? Why can't the server-side rendering server just resolve the data itself? And actually, GraphQL enables that, because GraphQL is independent of the protocol that you use to access and query the data. You can just run the GraphQL execution engine in your Node.js process, in your server-side rendering server, and you can get all the data that the client needs without even having to go talk to your API server, right? Which is literally just an HTTP endpoint that runs the GraphQL execution. And so that's why I call it a data access layer, because to me, GraphQL is a central data layer that you can just access from anywhere, whether that's via network or not, depends on the rest of your architecture, right? But you don't have to have it. It just knows what data exists, how to get it, and you can tell it what data you want, and it gives it to you as efficiently as possible.
So a lot of people who might tout GraphQL can get a response online, which is, okay, you're providing me a typed API that is broke down via resolvers. tRPC does that for me as well. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely some differences between them. The first one I can think of is, you can pick data pieces out of GraphQL, and that's up to clients. It puts the power more on the consumer, right? Are there other differences in terms of responsibility of who owns the API, who owns the schema, and who's using the schema that you can note between GraphQL and tRPC?
It's really funny that you ask, because a while back, I was invited onto a panel with Theo Brown, T3.gg, and it was a GraphQL versus tRPC panel. And I think people expected us to go up on stage and sort of battle it out, you know? And I was the GraphQL side and he was the tRPC side, and we were supposed to just like punch each other in the face. And we sat down on the panel on the stage and basically just violently agreed with each other for like an hour. And nobody really expected that. Everybody was surprised by us just violently agreeing, because the truth is that the technologies are really optimized for different use cases. At scale, makes very little sense, because the thing that it's optimized for is full stack TypeScript, right? That's what it's really great at. You write your API in TypeScript, you get the types, and you can just use them on the client, basically without a build step, without much complexity. You just access your data in a type-safe way. The developer experience is amazing. I love tRPC for that kind of use case where I have a full stack TypeScript app. Now, what do you do when you have a Swift iOS app? What do you do when you have customers that want to integrate with your API? What do you do when you got to go talk to many different microservices that are written in Kotlin, that are written in Java, that are written in Rust, that are written in Go, that are written in whatever other language that your teams internally want to use at scale, right? If you have many teams, they're going to be using a language that fits what they need to do with their service. tRPC isn't made for that use case. It makes no sense to use in that use case, right? It's even invented for, you can't even use it for the use case. And so again, it really boils down to, tRPC is great for the use case that it's optimized for, and GraphQL is great for the use case that it's optimized for, but you've got to choose the right tool for your use case. And again, going back to what you were saying earlier, the golden answer in engineering is, it depends, right? What are you trying to do? What are you trying to achieve? Where are you trying to go? What is your business trying to achieve? And how can engineering serve that purpose? And how can engineering serve your use case the best? And which tooling then fits it within that use case? That's really the big question.
So to make short of it, it's sort of like tRPC, it does something different, and it's really great when you are the consumer yourself and you're within the bubble of your app and you want a fully typed API experience, excels in everything. Could you see like tRPC being that first step that a team takes, a startup takes, they develop their API, they develop their app, and then they're like, okay, I need to make a Kotlin app. I have a partner that we need to integrate with. So then they can build the GraphQL off of that tRPC fundamentals that they've already spent time developing.
Going back to what you were saying during the intro, GraphQL being overhyped is a part of why I think it has declined in adoption in the broad developer space, right? And it's more seen in the enterprise space. I think the other part is too that GraphQL is a bit of a tooling problem, which is interesting because one of its strongest suits always has been tooling, right? A big part of the reason why so many people adopted GraphQL way back when it was hyped was because they had never been able to get that level of developer experience on the client, right? Every GraphQL API immediately comes with an API ID, GraphQL, right? You just know which data exists. You can write your query, you copy paste it, and it just works. And you can refetch it. The developer experience with React especially was just chef kiss at the time, right? There's nothing else that was comparable for any other API technology. Now, interestingly, it hasn't kept up with the times, right? The GraphQL clients really haven't meaningfully evolved over time. New ones have come up, but most people still use Apollo Client, right? Which is the big one. Mm-hmm. Relay is still as complex as it was at the beginning. And then there's new contenders like Urkel that are trying to bring more lightweight and improve developer experience again. But they're a little bit more niche because they're just newer, right? And less people know about them and they don't have the marketing power of the initial GraphQL hype wave behind them. But fundamentally, the tooling hasn't changed all that much. So if you think about, for example, the React world, I've been in the React world for almost 10 years now, since it first came out. And there was a lot of experimentation in the initial years, right? Up until 2019, 2020, every day it felt like a new React open source project was released, right? Because people were trying many different things. Initially, people were like, oh, Webpack's great. Oh, maybe we should use Parcel and build a different bundler. Oh, but if we can package Webpack into boilerplates, then people don't need to deal with the complexity of Webpack and they can just install a boilerplate and then it works. And then Next.js and Gatsby came out. And that was a big revelation because suddenly you didn't even think about Webpack anymore, right? It wasn't even a boilerplate where you had the configuration in your code base. It was just like a package and it just runs React for you. Same with Create React App, actually, maybe even before that was a really big improvement. And so the tooling first exploded in the way of like many different avenues were tried. And then the winning avenue was found. And then it was just double clicked on and just narrowed down and improved and improved and improved and improved. And now Next.js is far and away the way that people write React, right? It is the React framework and it is a fantastic experience to use React with Next.js. It took, I would say, 8 years of iteration to get to a point where that could exist, right? GraphQL, that iteration kind of stopped. For the first few years, there was a bit of that iteration. And then the community, the hype cycle died and Apollo sort of shifted really heavily to enterprise and federation. And that evolution never happened, right? There's no Next.js for GraphQL. Now, I'm not saying that a Next.js for GraphQL needs to exist and that is the right sort of analogy to think about, but it's to say that the tooling that GraphQL hasn't kept up with the times across the board, right? It hasn't kept up with what a modern developer expects across Prisma, across Next.js, across Drizzle, across all these modern tools that are simpler, they're more concise, they're more streamlined. They know more exactly what their focus needs to be and how they can execute on that focus. That doesn't really exist in the GraphQL world. As you were saying in the beginning, GraphQL comes with a lot of complexity and choices, right? To start using GraphQL, you really have to make 7 decisions, right? Which GraphQL server to use, which GraphQL client to use, which language to use, how do I architect my GraphQL API? Do I use GraphFast or not? There's all these different ideas on how to do this. And it's not really clear do I use Federation or not? There's no really clear guidance on when to use which one. And so all of this to say, to go back to your question, tRPC is a great way to get started. I wish GraphQL had that same great way to get started, right? I wonder what that would look like. Or even if tRPC was that way to get started, how could you make it easy to transition once you're at scale into a world where you're using GraphQL, right? Maybe that's the right way to think about it. That is not a thing that exists today. If you start off with tRPC and then you end up having to have mobile apps and different microservices in the background, you have a big problem, right? Like now you have to rebuild your whole API layer. Now you're at scale, you're going to have to redo the whole thing from scratch because there's no easy off-ramp. There's no easy off-ramp to a technology that is better optimized for scale.
I guess that was my question is, could GraphQL serve as that off-ramp to be your first, like the tRPC would be the first spoke going into your hub, and then you could like fan it out from there. And then I guess a follow-up question would be, we pinpointed GraphQL solving a problem of scale, and that's really where it becomes appropriate. So when you say it would be great if there was a getting started with GraphQL, if it's not really made for accessing the database, would that getting started serve its purpose in that sort of domain? Or is your getting started, Max, truly like, hey, we have like at least a couple microservices right now? Is that where the getting started point ideally should be? Or is there value in pushing it forward?
I think if you look at tRPC as well, like nobody accesses their database with tRPC. At some level, very early on, you do need a data access layer, usually an API that you access via the network. And you need a way to define what data exists and have the client get that data. And so if you think about it abstractly like that, I think there is a space to get started with GraphQL, even at a small scale, right? Back when we founded Spectrum, where we were using GraphQL for everything, we were 3 people, right? We were 3 co-founders sitting in our bedrooms hacking away, and we loved it, right? We thought GraphQL was the best thing since sliced bread. We were really happy with it once we had set it up and we were comfortable with it. But getting to that point, really isn't very easy. And then you're dealing with technical decisions where you're like, why am I, I'm like yak shaving here to the nth degree. Why am I thinking about how to generate types for my GraphQL queries? And then I have to hook up all these obtuse abstract configuration options just right. It feels like the Webpack time of 2014. I don't know if you were around, but we used to write these 1,000 lines of Webpack configuration to try and just render a freaking React app. And it was ridiculous, right? Nobody had the expertise on every single one of these weirdly named configuration options that were barely documented to really do that. And so we made an attempt at sort of trying to move GraphQL earlier and making it easier to use for these early stages with Fuse, which is an open source project that we launched, fusedata.dev, that essentially attempts to be like the next JS for GraphQL. And it's basically a CLI where you run fusedev and it spins up an API server and a GraphQL API for you and gives you a whole typed client out of the box, right? It just integrates with your Next.js or Angular or Svelte app, whatever you're using, and just gives you a GraphQL client that where you can access that GraphQL API. And you sort of get the getting started experience of just running create fuse app and you're good to go with a GraphQL API. I do still think that the complexity of GraphQL in terms of the learning curve is just higher than tRPC specifically. So I actually don't think that it's necessarily the perfect abstraction yet. It's a start. And it was an attempt at moving GraphQL earlier, but I think there's ways that you could abstract it even more and remove even more of some of the sort of learning curve and overhead of GraphQL. And that's something that we're thinking about at Stelly, because for us, obviously, we love GraphQL, right? And we want it to be used for use cases where it makes sense. And we want to encourage people to use it because it is a great way to build an API and to build a data access layer that just hopefully scales with you as your company hopefully grows, right? It shouldn't be a thing that you have to migrate to, because I will also say as a slight tangent, migrations to GraphQL at scale are difficult, right? And they take a lot of time just by pure virtue of you being at scale. If you have 400 engineers that build 4,000 microservices, migrating all of that to GraphQL is just going to take time, right? That is not an easy feat to accomplish engineering-wise. That is a complicated project that's going to take a long time. And you don't have a choice at that point, but can you set yourself up such that migration is easier? It doesn't even have to be done from the get-go. That's really where we're trying to go, to hopefully save organizations some of that time.
I love the comparison you used, like we're trying to do a Next.js for GraphQL. That really pinpoints, it feels clear to me, like a Prisma for insert database name. Can we talk about Fuse just for a minute or two? This is a really cool project that you guys are putting out. What are some of the things that a newcomer to GraphQL might look for that they see in other data access or API frameworks that they might pleasantly be surprised to find is sort of like taken care of in Fuse that might have been a little abstract in the base GraphQL docs? One thing that comes to my mind that I would want to ask about is authentication. GraphQL Shield was something that people would always reach for. Was that the best one to use? Who knows? What do you guys use?
So to answer your question abstractly, the thing that Fuse does really well is have opinions. It's on purpose we chose the GraphQL server that we know best, that we believe scales the best in the Node.js world, which is GraphQL Yoga. We chose the GraphQL client that we think is best for React and also Angular and Svelte and all these TypeScript frameworks called Urkel, because it's the smallest and yet the most modern and performant. And it also has fragment compositions and all these features that you want. We chose GraphQL Tada, which is a parser that gives you TypeScript types without having to run a code gen process. We chose all these technologies that hopefully our users don't even have to be aware of, right? They can just use Fuse and it just works, right? And under the hood, we use all these packages to wire it all together to make it work that the ecosystem has been working on for the last however many years, but you're never even aware of many of them. To answer your question about authentication specifically, the core realization that we had in Fuse that is pretty much the only additional abstraction that we added on top of these underlying tools was that you gain a lot of power from having the framework understand this concept of entities or resources. And what I mean by that is we have a thing that we call a node in Fuse. And a node is essentially just an object type if you've used GraphQL before. So it's like an object that has fields. The thing about a node is that it defines a load function that gets a list of IDs and then has to figure out how to get a list of those things. So for example, a product could be a node, right? And then the load function will get a list of IDs. And then you would have to access your database to fetch the products by that list of IDs. And then you define in a very type-safe way connected to your hopefully type-safe ORM, which of these fields do I want to expose, or which of these fields do I want to rename, or which other node do I want to connect it to? What does it mean to get a product's category or a product's reviews? Where do I get that from and how do I define that? So you're writing this very minimal set of code that sort of defines, here's an entity that I have, here's how to load it, and here's which parts of it to expose, how, and which other parts to connect it to. And that's really the only code that you have to write. Now, what's powerful about that abstraction is that with this abstraction, we now build in a lot of the GraphQL best practices that people usually have to figure out by themselves build in. If you've used GraphQL before, you've almost certainly used data loaders before, because they are almost a requirement to use with GraphQL to avoid the N+1 problems. Data loaders are a pain in the behind to use. They are an ugly abstraction in JavaScript because you end up with these loader.user.load calls all over your freaking API that call something that is defined somewhere completely different. And then that batches and caches all these database queries that you're trying to do into, again, these functions that get a list of IDs and then return the thing. With Nodes and Infuse, that is just built in. You literally never call a data loader yourself. We do that under the hood for you because when you're defining, hey, I have a query that says I get the top products, then you just type, hey, here's what it means to have the IDs of the top products. You know how to load a list of products. Go load the list of products and data load the whole thing for me under the hood. So that's an example of something that we just built in under the hood, where in other cases, you would have to figure out yourself, should I use data loaders or not? And how do I use data loaders correctly? And how do I architect them correctly? How do I not make them a mess? You don't even think about it in Infuse. It's just built in. Same thing with globally unique IDs, the relay style node query, all these security features around alias limiting, depth limiting, all these like sort of GraphQL exploits people do. Relay style pagination is just built in. You just go t.connection and you have a relay style paginated list really easily. It just does all of this stuff. It has all these opinions for you and builds it in to make it as easy as possible is really what the purpose is.
That sounds incredible for just making a simple chat application. You're really quickly going to run against pagination into an infinite query situation. That sounds fantastic. Circling back to the auth thing, though, did you have an opinion about that? Or is that kind of up to the user?
Oh, right. Thank you for the reminder. I totally forgot about your specific question there because I was talking about all the cool things in Fuse. I got excited for a second.
I got excited, too. Those are great.
Yeah. We do have authorization built in, which is what GraphQL Shield does. We don't touch authentication, right? Like Passport.js or whatever. That's up to you if you use Clerk or Passport.js or whatever. However you authenticate, that's on you. Mm-hmm. But we do have authorization, again, on a node level built in, because almost all the time, either on an object or on a field level, you want to say, hey, what does it mean to be able to access a user? And in fact, you want to just define that in one place. And no matter where a user is accessed anywhere in your API, it should always make sure, hey, are you actually allowed to access this user? Is that actually a thing that you can do right here, or is it not a thing that you can do? And again, same thing for fields, right? Maybe the username and profile picture are public, but their email is private, right? So you can just write an authorize function on either the sort of node or the field level to say, hey, here's what it means to be authorized to access this data. And that check will just run for you under the hood with the context of the request whenever that data is accessed, no matter where it's accessed from.
It's like row level security, but on your own schema.
Exactly, which, yeah. Again, row-level security is great if you're only using one database, which at scale, again, is not going to be the case.
And you never want to migrate.
Exactly. This is the thing about scale, right? You have many data sources, you have many microservices. So the solutions that are simple, that work great at a small scale, like row-level security is awesome, kind of start breaking down. And you need to control the authorization at your data access layer because that is the only layer that has all the information, right? That is, it accesses all of the data stores. And so you really want to move your authorization to that layer to make sure that you're handling it correctly and you're not stuck in your, I don't know, users table having to write row-level security and being like, oh man, the information whether or not that user can access this right now is some completely other data store somewhere else that handles permissions, for example, right? And it's now what do I do? Now I'm in a sort of a world of pain right now because now I got to move that to my application logic somewhere and now I got to make sure that it's applied consistently everywhere where somebody accesses this data. No, you just do it in your central data access layer once and you're good to go.
Because let's be real, unless you have a central authentication server, you know, your levels of authorization are never going to be congruent across different services. So you get two birds and one stone if you're putting it in a data access layer.
Yep.
That's now becoming quite clear. That's really neat.
I actually have a fun story about that. When Spectrum was acquired, usually when companies acquire other companies, they run security checks, right? Because you don't want to acquire something that has a huge glaring security hole, and then you're liable for anything that happens there. And so when GitHub acquired Spectrum, they naturally did a whole pen test. They paid 8 of the best pen testers in the world for an entire work week to try with full access to the entire code base and hack Spectrum. And now we were really worried about this, I will admit, because we were three founders in our bedrooms just hacking away at something as fast as we could, right? We didn't pay particularly much attention to security. The thing that we did was we made sure that every single resolver in our GraphQL API had an access control check, right? Every single time at the beginning of every single resolver, you would see something like Prisma dot, I forgot what the syntax was, but there was like some way to get a true or false back on a condition. And so you could write like Prisma dot, user is a part of this organization. And then, oh yeah, okay, cool. Now they can load the organization data. And so every single resolver just had one of these access control checks. And we made sure that every single one of them, that was pretty much the only security thing we did. What ended up happening is that this week-long pen test with 8 people didn't find a single major security issue. And I largely credit that to us having the central data access layer managing authorization and like this whole permissioning at that layer. They did find some minor issues in our actual authorization checks. In some edge cases, if you were a moderator of a channel, but not of the community, that is the higher level concept, you could edit the description of the community, even though you shouldn't have been allowed to. Like, these authorization checks weren't perfect, but the security holes they found were minor at best, right? And they were small edge cases within these authorization functions. They weren't like major glaring security holes that were going to lead to major problems, which made me feel really proud and really showed the power of doing the authorization at the data access layer, because it didn't matter what data we accessed. It was all secured consistently at that one layer where it was accessible.
It's like a battle test. You have people that are getting to the point where they're finding intersections and overlaps of specific application layer holes, and they can't even find something on the data access layer. So Max, if people are listening and they want to get their hands wet with GraphQL again, maybe that's starting a new project or converting a personal project they have, would you recommend people just download the Fuse stack, the Fuse framework, and just plug away? What's the best entry point for folks to try to start?
Pretty much go into the root of your project, run npx create Fuse app, and you'll be set up to just have a GraphQL API and fetch it. If you're in Next.js, it actually has an API route for you. It does all these things and understands Next.js natively, but also works with any other front-end framework because it's just GraphQL in the end, right? So there's clients for Angular, Vue, Swift, Kotlin, Java. It doesn't matter what client you have,
right?
It just works with it. And so it just spins up an API server for you. You have a GraphQL API out of the box, and you can start just hacking away, hopefully as efficiently and as effectively as possible. And then once you're at scale and you need caching, metrics, and security stuff, come talk to us. That's what we do at Stellate. So that's where we come in with our GraphQL CDN.
Max, it's been a pleasure talking about API development, like namely sustainable API development and how things are going to grow. I definitely learned a lot. So really appreciate your time coming on and sharing your experience and expertise with us today.
Thank you for having me. And thank you for letting me ramble about all of this for solely 40 minutes there. This was a lovely conversation.
It truly was. Thanks again.